She's calling you, man.
That's old school from the 70s. New York City's own James Walter Castor, known as Jimmy Castor, who made a name for himself by throwing everything into the pot. Disco, funk, Latin soul, pop, and a whole heap of humor and fun and wailing away on his saxophone. Jimmy was the leader of the Jimmy Castor Bunch, a funk band in the 70s that hit its peak with two singles that went gold within weeks of release, It's Just Begun and Troglodyte. What we just heard was, Hey Leroy, your mama's calling you. But you know, he started out in doo-wop with Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers in 1954. The band included a bunch of other people who were really, really into fun. Jerry Thomas on trumpet and keyboards, and he played with the Fatback Band in the 80s, Doug Gibson on bass, Harry Jensen on guitar, Lenny Friddle on congas, and drummer Bobby Manigault. Jimmy Castor died on January the 16th, 2012, from heart failure, 7 days before his 72nd birthday. An important note here is that he was a graduate of the High School of Music and Art. And I play these things sometimes, and I mention these things because those programs no longer are prevalent in the public school system, and they just don't exist anymore. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, September the 26th, and it is time to free your mind. You take the conversation wherever it is you want to go. But of course, so much has happened in this past week. There's no lack of topics to talk about. Call 888-874-4888 and be part of this consciousness-raising collective. We start in New York with Ma'at. You're on the air.
Yes. Hey, Eutrice.
Hi.
Good happy weekend to the PRN Lead Story family. I first want to say that your commentaries, I think one was yesterday on the settlement of $1.5 million, but no address to the attempted murder. I think that's excellent and profound and significant commentary, and we'll be looking for further of those analyses. My first question to you is, because I know you from the City Sun, is are you writing these days? And, you know, I'm not someone that's going to go on Facebook for a number of reasons, but I want to know if you would consider doing a book with the analysis about these situations where criminality is not even considered. And I think a piece of that, when you come up with the Southern Strategy per Reagan and Nixon, and decide to go after just people of color for the or behind the war on drugs, and because some folks are always going to alter their reality, and a lot of times it's plant substances. We're finding out that cannabis actually cures cancer and other alleviates many health problems. So I want to first know if you would consider doing a book that we will all help you promote and get a publisher for on such analysis. And the second part of my question is, because I heard you talking on Syria and that whole chaos, you know, where you actually create the gang and then you fight the gang. You on both sides all the time. I'd like to know if you've looked at and whether you considered, and the next time I share, I want to explain what John Lear said on a particular program, because some people don't always have the internet. But I want to know if you looked at the fact that September 11th, 01 was a false flag, and I'd like your thoughts on that. And I'll listen over over my phone line, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much for your call. To the first question, I've begun putting together editorials I had written all the way back to the City Sun days, and I already have a publisher, and we are going to I just want to put them together, because, you know, it's amazing that when I look back at some of the things that I had written, I go, wow. These things have actually been like prophecies, if you will, and I'm not trying to exalt myself, but they were so dead on to anticipating the eventual turn of events. You know, it's a good idea to do it, and so I am preparing to do that. The publisher I'm working with is a small publisher who's done really, really good work. And we're working together, so that's coming. The second piece about Syria, I have actually been reading what people have been saying. There are people far more expert about these two issues and areas than I. So I rely on the wealth of information that they have produced, and I mean, there is more than enough information available to make one come to the conclusion that we do not know all that is told to us. We don't know the real truth of these things until we rely on people who have put a great deal of themselves into investigating. So I'm just getting into it. You know, I've been reading like everybody else, but there are people who are experts on the subject matter, and I just rely on what it is they have to say, and also keeping in mind that they, too, are still researching. They, too, are still trying to find things out, but they do know considerably more than I do, so I rely on that. Thank you. From Connecticut, Tom, you're on the air.
You know, along the lines of the murders, the killings of black folks with police violence, the revelations that have come forth from John Rappaport and a lot of other people that have investigated the MMR vaccines, links to autism, research that was hidden, suppressed, that indicated a 360% higher incidence among young black males, infants, when they were given these course of injections. It's tragic when anyone dies, but to be horribly disabled for life with autism and to have no one be as outraged, seemingly, as some of these other events that have occurred, given these revelations, is kind of strange to me. I wonder if you were aware of any of this or you'd like to comment?
Well, I am not aware of the propensity of the vaccine to have such a devastating effect on African American young boys, but you know, I would start looking at that. Are you there, Tom?
He was a head researcher for the CDC, and has come forth after 10 years of being, I don't know, perhaps, you know, personally tormented by not letting this information out or having this information suppressed. And it's just, I don't know if it's just not widely dispersed or widely known, but once again, to the point of...
I'm just learning it from you today.
Oh, okay. Are you familiar with John? Because he was on PRN for a while.
Could you send me something
on leadstories@gmail.com?
Sure.
Yeah, he's got quite a few articles on his website where he's detailing this, and it's on quite a few other sites that cover alternate health. And it's just something that has been so dismissed by mainstream media. A little while ago, Katie Couric was dragged pillar to post because she had a guest that offered ideas that the vaccines were linked to autism in some way, and she was just vilified as even broaching the topic, some of her importance and some of her, you know, mainstream access. And yet to have something like this so suppressed is really quite tragic.
Well, thank you for bringing it to my attention. I appreciate it.
Yes, and I'll send you some links.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Harvey from California, you're on.
Hello, more than wonderful, you trees.
You are a spark. You really are. Thank you, Harvey. How are you doing today?
Great. And in reference to the march for the climate, I have a new idea, and it's called the water tax. It's like the carbon tax, you know, which is putting a tax on carbon. This is putting a tax on water for the utilities and the refineries. And here's why: that coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power are second only to agriculture in their daily use of our freshwater resources. And it turns out at the same time that once manufactured, solar panels use no water over the 20 to 25 year warranty. So I think it's really is time, if we want to save our freshwater resources, to put a tax on the water. For instance, the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant where we are here goes through, it pulls in 2.5 billion gallons of water a day, and it to cool the two reactors. And the thing is that in doing so, they also kill a tremendous amount of larvae, fish eggs, small fish, and creatures. They get caught up against the screens. And every once in a while, they have to close the plant down because they have a jellyfish invasion that blocks the intake valves to, you know, and so they have to clean it all out. And so not only do they use our tremendous amount of water, but at the same time they're killing many of our fish. And I'm wondering, if you multiply that time with all the plants, the coal, the natural gas and nuclear, and the oil that take in all that water every day, as well as refineries, that they kill a large part of America's aquatic food stock, and they're not taxed for that. And at the same time, it's just like the refinery, you know, it takes about 100 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of gasoline. So they really are using our commons. They're not really paying for it. And at the same time, they're producing the carbon that's creating climate destabilization. So I feel that it really is time to put a tax on water for utilities and refineries. And I say, let's get star-powered, especially if we want to save our water resources. Let's get solar. Thanks, you two. Well,
thank you very much. Mitch from New York, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Latrice.
Hi, how are you?
I enjoy your program very much.
Me too.
I don't leave the house until your program goes off, and then I sit down and I think about 5 minutes. I like the analogy that you gave, I think it was Tuesday, about the so-called primitive societies where there's no homelessness, there's no prisons, and everybody eats. So it gives one wondering who really are the primitive people. You know, in the so-called civilized world, you have that in rampant, mm-hmm. You know. And I also like to bring up the idea of the police department and the police state that we're living in now, that actually this was set up to control in the 1700s, it was set up to control black people who were enslaved. And it was embedded in the Constitution by the so-called family fathers, who were all slave owners, racist.
But bigots. Where was it buried in the Constitution?
The Second Amendment. The Second Amendment states that all white men in the South, or at that time slavery was all through America, should have should be involved in a militia, a state militia. And it is embedded in the Constitution with the Second Amendment saying that the right to bear arms. Now, the right to bear arms was given to the states so that they could set up these militias to control the slaves. It wasn't to put in there to protect the country. It was put in there by James Monroe, who himself owned about 400 slaves and was attacked on his plantation at one time to have militias in each state, and everybody, each person, each male 18 years and over had to belong to this militia. And that militia, it had the right every month to go into each slave's home or on a plantation or wherever they were housed and search. And if you were found in violation of material or ammunition or weapon, then you were given 25 lashes. So I ask you, I mean, isn't that what's going on today with us as a people living here in this country? And later on, you know, when you it was passed, the Dred Scott decision, which says a black man has no rights that a white man has to respect. And it was reinforced by Barack Obama when he invited this gentleman from Massachusetts to the White House to have beer because he had insulted him on the air, you know. So I ask you, I wonder, is there any justice that can be found in this country by black people, seeing the history of it?
Well, I think that's a great conversation piece. Let's see what people are saying. Oh, by the way, you know, the word patrol also comes out of the slavery era, because the people who were sent out to find slaves who might have run away from plantations, they were called patterollers. They were sent out, they were rolling out, actually, listening for the patter of escaping feet. So patterollers, and now we have patrollers. So
yes.
It's an interesting derivation of the word. Thank you very much, Mitch, for your call today. And thanks so much for listening. Thank you. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
And to you. You sound all sprightly today.
You treat I am. I hope I stay this way throughout the rest of the call. I know, you know, I tend to go off on the deep end, but I'm going to try not to hyperventilate today. But let me give the greetings as well to the PRN audience, and I hope everyone have an enjoyable weekend and do something very fun with yourself and the family. But you treat, what I wanted to touch on today, the taxes that Harvey was mentioning, the water tax. When people start saying taxes, you treat, I get very, very nervous because I deal with taxes all the time, and I know who always end up having to pay those taxes are always us, the lowly taxpayer, and not these corporate entities. They're going to find a way to pass it on to us, and they're not going to pay. So we need to come up with a better scheme if these people are using the water, and we want these companies to pay their share of what it is that they need to pay, there has to be a better way, because we, the taxpayers, are going to be the ones stuck with that bill. On the other thing, you, Teresa, I must commend you again to having on Dr. Gerald Horn on again, and, of course, he gave us some food for thought as to what it is in geopolitical realm that's going on. This president, you, Teresa, I do not listen to this man because he gets on my last nerve when he gets on here and he speaks, because he does this Orwellian double speech thing, and people who are not very astute. Hello, Utrecht?
I'm listening very intently.
Okay, because I thought I heard somebody was fooling with the lines. No, but no, what I was saying, he has a way of doing this speech thing that if people are not very astute and they don't pay close attention to him, they get all taken up, because a lot of us, we get caught up in emotional rhetoric. And we don't focus on the actual wording of what this person is saying. We go with their mannerism, which is one reason, you treat, I prefer to listen to a speech or read it than to watch the person, because a lot of us get distracted in the visualization of what you see and you don't pay attention to what he is saying. This man is, in essence, has said it is okay for the United States to take it upon themselves to go and bomb sovereign nations, to go ahead and topple a regime, remove this person from power, just the same way how he did with Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq, because the man said he was not going to enforce the status of forces agreement, which is normally referred to as the SOFA agreement, with the U.S. policy, because they were raping, they were doing a lot of things to the Iraqi people, and he said he was not going to uphold that, the new status of forces agreement. That is why he had to get on up out of there. And they did everything they can to depose him and put him out of office. They've been trying their hardest to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. They've been trying to get him out. And now they're going to come around with the ISIS, the ISIL, and you know, whatever ICE they're going to come up with next in order to try and destroy this country. And in the process, if they assassinate this man, then that's all gravy. It's all for the gander. And when I sit back and I see people, especially black people, and they're cheering this on because it's this mascot of a black-looking individual who is doing these things, who's being put out front in order to be the spokesperson to do it, it makes me really and truly sick to my stomach. Because it has shown the low that we have gotten into to see that this is what you want to become. You want to have assimilated yourself to such a point to become so accepted in a system where now you have taken on the most demonic aspect of this system in order to think that now you have fit in. Now they're going to accept you. We are never going to be accepted, you tree. We are
now,
never
let me,
going
let me
to...
ask you, the black people,
yes,
you're
ma'am,
referring to, are you talking about the Congressional Caucus? Are you talking about black people in general?
I'm talking about the CBC members, as black politicians, as well as black people out here in general. Because I'm talking to a lot of common everyday people, and they're all enamored and all taken up with this family, this black family in the White House, and they can't see beyond that. They cannot see beyond that imagery. And they're not seeing the damage that is being done by this man. Because here you're going to go before the United Nations. Well, forget the United Nations, because the United Nations is a cover for white supremacy. That's where they go on up in there, and they do all their dirt. Because here you have the African, 54 countries on the African continent, and not one of them have a permanent seat on the Security Council. So that should already tell you that you have a majority world population that is not white. But they're not sitting on this doggone council. It's a council of a bunch of white people sitting up there making decisions that the rest of the world going to have to put up with. But here it is. You're going to go before this council. You're going to tell them what you plan on doing. You're going to make it seem so all high and high-handed that you are trying to look for the good of people. But how can you look for the good of people when you're dropping drones and you're killing people? There's been a lot of children that have been killed, and they call it collateral damage, and that makes me sick. When I hear people using this word collateral damage and it's a clean kill, what the hell is a damn clean kill? If you are still dead, there's no such thing as a clean kill. And these are the things that you hear black people are saying. It's a
very important, very important point that you're making in terms of people needing to examine and you know, really examine the situation as it is and to come to the conclusion that, you know, do you sanction this because the president is a black man? Do you give him a pass because he is enacting some of the most inhumane policies both at home and abroad? Do you give him the elastic to do that, to just give him extra consideration and to overlook a lot of these things? This is a very important question. I've been asking it for a long time. Thank you so much for your call today. And you better have a good weekend. You need it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Have a great weekend. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much.
So take us into your mind today.
Yeah,
what are you freeing your mind of?
There's a lot to talk about. You were right about that. I guess today the thing that's on my mind the most is about this really disturbing trend where the black men and involved shootings or police involved shooting of black men. Not that it hasn't always been there, but it seems to be reaching some frightening heights. And I think there are a few reasons for this. We know some of them, but some of them are kind of under the surface. I'd like to talk about a couple of cases. Now, just this past Wednesday, they released a videotape of a case that hadn't gotten so much media, which it should have, which I talked about before on this show, was the case of John Crawford III in Beaver Creek, Ohio, who got shot in a Walmart by the police while he was carrying around a BB gun at Walmart sales. Now, this videotape they released, they waited until after the grand jury in that state came back and said that they were not going to prosecute either one of these officers and that they were not going to face any charges. Now, when you can see why they didn't want this released beforehand, because the outcry of people would have been so pronounced and so that they would have had to bring some kind of charges against somebody. Go over it if people don't know the case I'm talking about. John Crawford, on August the 5th of this year, went into a Walmart store in Ohio, Beaver Creek, and he picked up a BB gun off the shelf. It was a loose BB gun that looks sort of like an assault rifle, but only a little bit smaller. And he's walking around the store with it, it's... by the way, I should say that Ohio is an open carry state where people can walk into a store with their real guns. And many people do that. They go into bars, in fact, and in other places with their guns in plain sight, real guns. But, of course, we know these laws don't really apply to black men. So what happens is he's walking around in the store in the Walmart and talking to his mother of his children on the cell phone and just looking around, I guess, for gifts or something, and he goes and picks up the rifle, goes onto a couple of more aisles in the store, and then he goes onto this pet aisle, and he's looks like he's engaged in a conversation pretty heavily, and he's just moving the gun around, hitting stuff on the shelf. At no point anywhere does he point this rifle at anybody or threaten anybody, or even people are passing him up and not even giving it a second thought. But this one couple decides, white couple, decides to call the police and say that there's a black man in the store with a gun, not only did they say that, and I heard one call, and I've heard interviews with Ronald Ritchie, who is the male in this situation, who called the police. After that, they say that he tells the 911 operator that he is pointing the gun at people, and in fact, he just pointed it at two children. He says this all on the 911 tape. Then the police eventually come about a minute and a half later, and they have all this on tape. They give a warning while he's talking on the cell phone. The interval between when they told him to put it down and shoot is only about, it's a millisecond. It's not even a whole second. They didn't give him time to react. So I say that because, well, I'm bringing up this case because it seems that anytime you come out as a black man, they're expecting you to be a danger. They're expecting you to be breaking the law. They're expecting you to be violent. They're expected to have to shoot you. And I think, in my opinion, that not only should these officers be fired and possibly brought up on charges, but the person who made the 911 call lied, and they should be hyped these police officers up to the point. He raised the level, the stakes. He raised it by lying. You see what I'm saying? And I feel that.
But he changed his statements later and said that, you know, basically he had lied. He was incorrect when he said that the gun was being pointed at people.
Exactly.
But this is after the killing occurred.
But when you look at this tape, you assume that they have the 911 call synced up to the tape as closely as they could. And they have the 911 call, and they show the two kids and the woman come onto the same aisle as Mr. Crawford and then leave and go away. At no point does he ever point the thing at anybody. It's what it is. And they have a term for this. They call it being swatted. I don't know if you've ever heard of that term. It's where someone sets you up and calls the police on you and basically lies on you in an attempt to just see if you're going to get arrested or get shot or get something done to you, you know, on purpose. And I believe that this is kind of what this man did.
So what is the significance of this case to you?
Well, I was going to point out a short other example of a man in South Carolina who was purportedly being stopped because it's a black man, I believe he was 31 years old, Lamar Jones, I think his name is, being pulled over or whatever for not having a seatbelt on. And actually, it wasn't a pullover. He gas station and jumps out of his car. And as he's getting out, the officer rolls up right behind him, white officer, tells him, you know, let me see your license. I mean, this is on videotape too, dash cam. Says, let me see your license. The guy reaches back in his truck to get his license, you know, because a lot of guys, they don't, it's just shorts or something like that. You might take your wallet and put it on your dashboard or on your, in between the two seats because it's uncomfortable to sit on a wallet like that. So anyway, he's reaching back in and the cop just starts shooting at him.
Mm-hmm.
Before he gets, you know, and then the guy tries to jump back out of the vehicle and get out of the way. He ends up shooting him in the hip and dang near paralyzing him. And this all because this officer is so jumpy and so antsy because it's a
Oh, your phone is blacking out quite a bit.
Excuse me?
Your phone is blacking out quite a bit.
Oh, is it? Okay,
but,
I'm sorry.
But we're getting the thrust of what you're saying.
So
you've
what I'm
highlighted
saying is,
these two cases. Why?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that this shows me, these two cases and all these other cases that are happening, shows me that there's a culture going on amongst police agencies where they are being trained or being basically told to the effect that when you're dealing with someone who's black, be on extra alert, be ready for this, be ready for that. I don't know if they're actually being told it in those terms, But it seems to be an understood type of... You see what I'm saying? And also, Dred Scott...
You just faded out again. I don't... It said, it seems to be an understood type of... And I didn't hear the rest.
I said, it seems to be an understood type of policy that's understood and maybe not spoken so much, is that when you're dealing with a black man, you're to expect...
Okay.
Some violent means automatically without even assessing the situation. And this is very frightening because it looks like it's getting worse. It's getting worse because these officers are never prosecuted. And they feel they have...
You put a lot on the table today, DX, so we'll see how people are reacting to it. I want to thank you for your call today. Thank you so much. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Yatrice, how you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I want to talk to you and probably ask you something about this. This is in regard to, you know, local Chicago politics, which is a lot different from a lot of political machines across the country. But this week, a group of prominent Chicago ministers, including one, Corey Brooks, I don't know if you remember, he made national news as being the rooftop pastor last year. He camped out on his roof until the city of Chicago gave him a building to build a community center. Well, apparently, him and a group of other prominent ministers came out at a press conference with Republican gubernatorial candidate Bruce Rauner. Apparently, Illinois is going to be going through the election of governor in November, and Bruce Rauner is the Republican candidate going up against the current Pat Quinn, who is the Democratic governor of Illinois. The thing I was wondering about was, you know, I understand that the Democratic Party has not been, you know, so friendly, matter of fact, to the point of detrimental to the black community. And this is in regards to the black church as well, which is a whole different topic. But the thing is that, is it the right move to just, you know, to just switch party lines, you know, just like that, when Bruce Rauner is basically a Reaganomics type of Republican who is basically a union buster? He's pro-charter school. He's anything you can think of, you know, that is wrong with the Republican Party. So but the thing is that, and I had, you know, discussions with a couple of people in regards to this, and the thing is that, why isn't it just enough just to say, hey, look, we're not going to support the Democratic Party, and that's it, instead of just saying, you know, we're just going to switch alliances, or we're just going to, basically, which I think, you know, whoever's came the most out of each party, because I think, honestly, this is just basically a, you know, a payout to, you know, these particular ministers, you know, and like I said, they're prominent ministers in Chicago.
Why did you decide not to see it as also exercising a political choice?
Because I think the thing is that going from one wrong party to the other wrong party is not the right move. You know, because the thing is that, you know, honestly, to me, they're basically mirrors of each other. So you're
but
just
is
going
it,
from
is it a matter of being right, or is it a matter of being strategic? Look, suppose that the reasoning is this. I'm not saying that it is, but suppose the reasoning is this, that anything but the Democratic Party is the message.
Yeah, and I agree with that. Just, you know, I think just say, listen, we're not going to support the Democratic Party anymore. And that's it. And then go strategically map out another plan instead of just, you know, making this rash move of just, okay, let's support the other guy. You know,
is the Republican Party giving them any promises about anything that you know of? Have they discussed, well, it's not that we're in love with the Republican Party, but they at least are giving us A, B, C, D, and E that we've been asking for a long time.
Well, here's the problem, and this is the problem I have. When I saw the press conference and read the news reports, everything was basically about what the current governor, Pat Quinn, hasn't done for the black community, which is all true. You know, Pat Quinn has abandoned the black community as well. But the thing is that And I'm asking the same question. What is the Republican Party giving us? What is Bruce Rauner offering us besides more charter schools and busting unions? You know, that's what I want to know.
That's a great question. And these are the important questions. It might be a very good strategy to say, we're leaving the Democratic Party. We're urging our people to leave the Democratic Party. And we this time around, we're placing our bets with the Republicans because we need somebody to win. And we have an opportunity here to work something out, even with this record that the Republican candidate seems to have, that we can get something. And these are the things that we are talking to him about, and these are some of the things that he has promised to do. That would make sense. But to switch just for the sake of switching doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly. And here's another caveat, too, because, as you know, the Chicago mayoral election is right around the corner.
Right.
And the problem is that this actually might affect what's going to happen in the Chicago mayoral election, because as crazy as it sounds, Pat Quinn and Rahm Emanuel have not been friends on a lot of things. However, Bruce Rauner and Rahm Emanuel share the same quality, the same political record. So I hate to say this, but those same group of ministers that's supporting Bruce Rauner might come up again supporting Rahm Emanuel.
This is the time for the community now to step in and say, all right, you've made a move that we don't understand and we don't agree with. But in as much as you've made the move, this is the time to get up front before the election. You've already kind of put the cart before the horse by announcing that essentially you're going with this guy. But what basically are you negotiating for? What is it that you're doing? This is a time for the community to step up and ask these questions. And if they don't get good answers, this is also the time for the community to get loud about the fact that these ministers are accommodating the policies that are going to be harmful to the community.
And I agree, because the problem is that I mentioned Cory Brooks because he's one of the most known ministers in Chicago. And, you know, the thing about it is that, and going back to the Black church, people get so loyal with ministers that they cloud their political judgment a lot. So it's like if there's one particular minister that's going with them, they make this excuse like, hey, you know, he can do this for us and do that for us. Well, did he actually say that? Did he actually announce that? You know, because
this is a time for the community to ask the exact questions that you are asking. In as much as these folks position themselves and are, in fact, leaders in their own right, and are, in fact, influencers of opinion, in as much as they are functioning as ambassadors to the political process in the name of these constituencies that they represent, it is time for people to step up and ask, what is it that the community is going to get because you are asking their support of a person that has a really horrid political record? And
yeah.
what made you do that? You know, there's a lot of money in elections, and that is a primary voter, a primary motivator. I'm not saying that that's the case now, but it is not at all to be dismissed. It's a very important influencer of opinion. So this is a time, I think, Henry, we both agree. This is when the community needs to step up, because you're highlighting a departure from the norm. But look, in Florida, we have the gubernatorial candidate who has moved and switched from the Republican to now back to Democrat. Switching a party is itself not a big deal. It could be if depending on the amount of time the candidate has been in a particular party, but it is more important to find out what is the benefit of supporting such a person. That's the major issue here.
And to end it off, too, because, like I said, it worries me because this could affect the Chicago election, because now now it's Karen Lewis, who is the potential, who is potentially running for mayor, is getting into a Twitter argument with Cory Brooks about this whole thing. So
she is the head of the Chicago Teachers Union.
And she is the head of the Chicago Teachers Union and possibly a mayoral candidate. She still hasn't announced yet. And the problem to me is that, you know, this could, you know, with her getting into this, you know, war words with Cory Brooks, you know, could hurt her chances as well. And, you know, like I said, I still think that Rahm still has a good chance of winning this election, even though I would not like him to win. And I know we talked about this before about, you know, trying to use Kara Washington's playbook. You know, I just don't think that any of the candidates are politically savvy like Harold Washington. I just don't think that they have that savviness that Harold has. Because Harold, you know, he was basically one of the smartest political minds to come out of Chicago.
No question.
I don't see that in any of the candidates. Even though I like a lot of what the other candidates are saying, they just don't have the experience and they don't have the savvy that Harold has. I would suggest people, you know, outside of Chicago who don't know what Harold's done to pick up the autobiography of Harold Washington by Dempsey Travis. And it tells you a lot about how Harold came up in the political system and how instead of going head on with the Democratic Chicago machine, he went around them and was able to do what he needed to do. Because the problem is that you can't go head up with the Democratic political machine, but you can go around it. and that's what Harold
But did. It also takes time. And this is a fatal mistake that many candidates who otherwise would be extremely attractive, they make a fatal mistake and they actually short-circuit the potential to be of service. And that is, you can't raise money, organize a political base, and run a campaign all at the same time.
Exactly.
It will not work. You just can't work. And the candidates who are emerging are just doing exactly that. And they may be attractive candidates probably in a couple of years or so after they have organized a base, after they have, you know, put their soldiers in order, and after they have put a political process of their own that they control together and then run. But it is important that they understand you can't do all three things at the same time. I mean, not that you can't. You can't say 100% it would fail, but the statistics are suggesting it would fail.
And that's the same mistake Harold made in the 77 mayoral election. So he regrouped, and just like you said, he learned from his mistakes and came back and won.
But he also, in that election, did something that was extremely important, and that was he widened his political base and brought in a true coalition effort. There were many whites who stepped into Harold Washington's campaign in a very significant way and brought in and broadened his political base so that white Chicagoans got used to the idea that, yes, there is competent black leadership. You know what I mean? This was a major racial hurdle, and it is a racial hurdle that everybody has to deal with. Look what Barack Obama capitulated completely just to accommodate that racial hurdle, mm-hmm. to persuade whites that he was competent. Well, of course, you know, that was a misjudgment. when you look at where he's taken us. But altogether, but you know, what Harold Washington did in that instance was he broadened his base, and he also beefed up his original constituency. He really went at, you know, the business of getting more people from his organic community in, and that was great. A stupendous politician, and anybody wishing to run from the community ought to have the Harold Washington political manual. That's the one that you've got to do. Harold Washington, and you have Coleman Young, and you have Adam Clayton Powell, and you're good.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your call today. We have a little bit of time, Yvette, for your call. A tiny
Hi
bit
there.
Of time,
can you
but
hear me
you
okay?
Take it.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
But I just want to say hello to the PRN listeners. I really enjoy listening to Sarah, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so this is my first time calling in, and what I wanted to talk about was we had a shoot. I'm calling from Toronto, Canada, and we had a shooting here on Wednesday evening. Now, apparently, it was police who shot this young black man. I'm really nervous. I'm so sorry. They shot this young black man, and apparently someone saw that he was handcuffed before he got shot. The police are not releasing any information about the incident, so we really don't know what happened. But they are saying that he was a thug, he was a drug dealer, and all of this foolishness. But the mother is saying that he was a very good person. He was very intelligent. He was studying at the University of Vancouver. So we don't know what's going on. So I just feel like Ferguson is here. Ferguson is all around the world. And I feel like there's a war on African people all around the world, and we don't realize what's happening to us.
That's, well, I think that that is becoming more and more a sentiment, because Ferguson is not just about the police killing. It's also about the rise in status of the police as a mechanism of state control.
Yes.
Now, that is definitely taking hold as part of the consciousness of people. It's not just about the police killings. That's been going on. But now, with the militarization, you even have even libertarians like Rand Paul talking about this. This is beginning to settle in to the national psyche as an example of the creeping fascism, if you will, of the state. The state power has increased, and it's being evidenced in the relationship of the police more and more as a repressive force rather than a police force. And this is the consciousness. If you're telling this even from Canada,
this is
the mindset that this around situation in Ferguson has engendered.
Yeah. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, thank you so much, Yvette, for your call today. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. And thanks for listening. And today, I just want to let you know, there is a concert. I'm going to be up there for it at St. James Presbyterian Church. This is a 119-year-old church. I love this church because the first pastor was Samuel Cornish, the father of the Black Press. And there are tickets available. A few tickets are available. If you are in Manhattan today, I suggest you get them. The concert is October the 18th, but tickets have been vanishing. So there are only a very, very limited number of tickets left. Call 917-514-6523. 917-514-6523, and get your tickets if you're in Manhattan today. Somebody will meet you and get you your tickets. I urge you to be there. I'm going to be there. This is a fundraiser for St. James Presbyterian Church. I happen to know that a very, very popular person, Alton Maddox, will also be there. So there are people who are excited about that and greeting him and saying thank you for coming back to the world of litigation. We need it. So if you are interested in supporting St. James Presbyterian Church, this church is a fixture in the community and an incredible history, and I'm delighted to be a part of its fundraising effort because at 119 years old, we hope that it remains 119 years more. So I urge you to support it. Tickets are vanishing. Get yours today. Again, the number to call, 917-514-6523. Tell them you're with Lead Stories and you would want to be in the company of really great people on October the 18th at this concert. Thank you so much for joining me today and every single day here on Monday through Friday on PRN.FM. Please pass the word and let this audience go bigger and bigger. I love the idea. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. And have a great weekend now that you have freed your minds, and we connect again on Monday. Bye-bye.